Hello, a warm welcome to you. Thanks for joining us. As you know, we are now on chapter 6 of the Bhagavad Gita. And as you have established yourself, and as have I, that every time you read this chapter and every other chapter of the Bhagavad Gita, we find more to read, more to learn, and more to understand. It is actually quite amazing how much of depth this book has. Sister Denise is kind enough to share her wisdom and understanding with us, and I welcome her to the studio again today.
Thank you. Thank you.
Sister Denise, I've noticed that there is a number of aspects in the first part of the chapter that you and I have covered already. I'm referring to aspects of renunciation, sacrifice, rituals, etc. So I'd like to go directly to verse number 5. When I read this, I realized that there have been entire books written on this shloka alone, both in Hindi and in the West. One should uplift oneself by the self, capital S. One should not degrade oneself, for the self alone can be a friend to oneself, and the self alone can be an enemy of oneself. That is very, very powerful. How do you understand it?
You are your own best friend, you are your own worst enemy. This is the phrase that tends to be used. You know, it depends on you how you think about yourself. You know, some people are very critical of themselves, you know very well, and they will see themselves in terms of what's wrong. One of the aspects of this is perfectionism. And perfectionism is something that happens as a reaction to trauma of one sort or another. We were talking earlier about trauma. But to be kind to the self, to give oneself a break, to do things which are really beneficial to the self, to actually, you know, plan your life around what is really good for me, is very good. I think one of the difficulties that a person will encounter is the moral injunctions which say, with a finger wagging, don't be selfish. And a lot of the good, friendly way that a person can be towards the self is sabotaged by this moral injunction. So you have to be careful of those. Being your own worst enemy is where you sabotage yourself. And these are all to do with dysfunctional family relationships and so on and so forth. But to really be your own friend, you have to honor what you are and honor your value. And I think it's very difficult for people who are raised in a moral environment which says that is suspect. You know, so we have these two trends. On the one hand, one should be good to oneself, and on the other, it's like this expression we also have, spare the rod and spoil the child. You know, it actually really spoils a person to give physical violence to a child is the most damaging thing you can do. And yet, so many scriptures say you have to beat the child into submission in order to make him good. So there's something very skewed going on here. And I think that when you see a shloka like this, which says you are your own best friend, you are your own worst enemy, then we say, okay, no matter what anybody else has done to me or whatever has happened to me, my life is in my hands. Now, what am I going to do for me? That's a very, very good thing to think about.
That's a very deep question. I think we can spend the entire half hour talking about this particular verse, but we need to move on. It's interesting, Sister Denise, that this particular verse leads on to the next one that reads, for him who has conquered himself by the self, the second self, capital S, the self is a friend, also capital S, but for him who has not conquered himself, the self remains hostile like an enemy. verse 5 and verse 6 refers to your internal world, doesn't it? Now, Sister Denise, why are so many of us unaware of our internal processes? What makes us so reluctant to get to know the person within? Also, how do you understand shloka number 6?
The thing that turns us against ourselves and the thing that keeps us away from our inner self is, I think, the prevailing social attitudes which say you have to be operating in the external. And you find this particularly in the Western world. I found it very much in the United States, where everything is about being out, you know. And children are very strongly discouraged from being solitary, from daydreaming, from playing by themselves and making their own toys and things like that, because it's not commercially viable. That sort of really causes the inner world to become an inner desert, and one does take so much strength from a very well-populated, a beautiful inner world. So that's a very important thing. I remember one time being in Bolivia on top of one of the Andean peaks, and I saw some llamas, and then after a while I saw a little boy who was the herder of the llamas, and he was essentially alone all day watching over the llamas. But you could see in the eyes of this child how his solitude had caused him to really create a very beautiful inner world, and he would sing and he would, you know, appreciate the rather sparse nature around him, but he was really, really in tune with something very important, which I think the modern world denies us, and that's really a tragedy, actually. We were looking in this verse at the big S and the small S for the self, and I think that many people do experience there are two people inside. There's the real me and there's some other me. Or you can say there's the pure me, the powerful me, and then there's a fake me. There's the me who is full of doubts, who is uncertain, who doesn't know who one is. You know what I mean? And I think that the terminology that we would use in Brahma Kumaris is the body conscious self, for the one with the little s, the one who is disconnected really from the essence, and the soul conscious self. And so what has to happen in spiritual practice is you need to intensify your sense of identification with this, sometimes people call it the higher self, and then the other self, the self which is under the influence of materialism, who is completely under the sway of the sense organs and sense perceptions and objects of sense perception. We need to be clear, which is the real me?
One spends years answering that question, doesn't one? Mm-hmm. Mr. Denise, can you, as an individual, become spiritually enlightened if you are psychologically damaged? The reason I'm asking the question, because conquering the self means coming to terms with your own past and your own pain.
Well, this expression that you're using, coming to terms, is very important. Coming to terms with your own past, coming to terms with your own pain, it's very important work. And the whole thing of coming to terms, we have to come to terms with what we are, what we have become, and then from there move forward. In answer to your other question about can you develop yourself spiritually if you're psychologically damaged, what I have observed in the many years that I've been working with the knowledge of the Gita and the practice of Raj Yoga and so on, is that the word psyche and the word soul is the same. Psyche is the Greek word for the soul. And so to know the soul, to study the soul, to study the self, you find that the spiritual and the psychological, they overlap a great deal. And when you want to develop yourself spiritually, you want to become a good meditator, an upright person, make yourself strong, etc., after a little while, you will come up against your psychological issues. Then you will have to work through them in order to be able to get on to the next bit. Because I think that if you really want to do a spiritual practice seriously, you're climbing a mountain or you're climbing a tree, or there's climbing involved, and it becomes more rarefied. There's less people on that level than there are on the lower levels, because human society is a bit pyramidal in this way. If you have a psychological weakness that you haven't addressed, it's going to really be an Achilles heel for you as you move forward. As you go along in your spiritual practice, whichever angle you go for, you'll come up against stuff, and that will block you, and that you have to work through. And if it takes time, let it take time. Mm. There's no rush.
Yes, Sister Denise, you know, when it comes to pain, we're reluctant to go there because of the fear of experiencing more pain when you touch it. How does one begin that journey of healing in terms of conquering the self? Because I'm of the view, from when I read this three shlokas, that self-healing is implicit in this. Sister Denise, I have a friend who's a biokineticist, and what I learned from her is that if there's injury to any part of muscle, joint, and bones, you first have to heal the injury before making it strong.
The psyche does, I think it does work in a similar principle. There is a way that is done called original pain work, which I found particularly interesting, because where there is a trauma, which very often happens, you know, very early in life, where you're particularly vulnerable, particularly soft, particularly shocked by whatever that is, the wound goes very deep. And what happens to many people if they experience a bad wound in early life is it gets buried. You don't even know about it. You could even completely forget the incident until you're mature enough, I think, to deal with it. So I think, you know, when a person starts to get interested in pursuing the spiritual aspect of their life, if it's later in life, it means you're doing it having experienced life, having gone through a number of relationships, a number of situations, and so on. So you have certain experience. If, on the other hand, you start your spiritual practice very young, and I started mine quite young, then as you continue, you acquire experience along the way. So anyway, experience is important, and study is important, experimentation with the practice is important, because spiritual practice is for the purpose of becoming whole, integrated. There's a connection between being integrated and being a person of integrity. So where you have a wound, you have to be willing to go where the pain is. And our society normally tells us pain is to be avoided at all costs. And I think when you come into a spiritual practice, you start to realize that that is an attitude that needs to be challenged. Because pain is a messenger. Pain is a great teacher.
And it doesn't go away by itself.
No. And pain has a message to bring to you, and if you avoid it, you take all sorts of medication, this, that, and the other, then the pain will have to be intensified in order for you to say, okay, what's the message? And you won't get the message until you embrace the pain. You hear in the Gita the word endurance comes up from time to time.
Yeah.
And life is painful very often, and that pain has to be endured, but it also has to be embraced, and you have to look at it and see, you know, exactly what is this, because pain and working with your pain is the thing that helps you to become complete again and to be mature and to also be compassionate. Because a person who has never worked through their own pain, they may be quite hard-hearted, not very nice to other people, not be able to empathize or sympathize.
Yeah. I think, Sister Denise, that very few people have understood that 5, 6, and 7 means what you just said it means. I think very few do. Sister Denise, there's a term that is mentioned in verse 8, which I find very interesting, and I'd like you to explain the entire shloka as well as that last line to us. The yogin who is satisfied with knowledge and discrimination, who is unchanging with conquered senses, to whom a clod, a stone, and gold are the same, is said to have attained samadhi. What is samadhi?
Samadhi is like enlightenment. Samadhi is also, you know, the person who's in samadhi, they are in this state of realization and they leave their body like that, sitting down. There's another very interesting word connected with samadhi, which is nirvikalpa samadhi. Nirvikalpa samadhi means that you're in such a state of clarity that you no negative thought arises. And that is really something that the Brahma Kumaris Raj Yoga really talks to us about, that we need to reach a point where we do not entertain any negative thought, any waste thought. Samadhi, I've arrived kind of thing, it means that.
I have arrived. That's a nice definition. The first two lines, the yogin who is satisfied with knowledge and discrimination. How is discrimination used in this sense?
If you look at the Sanskrit, I wouldn't really use the word discrimination for this, because the Sanskrit says gyan and vigyan. So vigyan is that which lies beyond gyan. So it's like physics and metaphysics. The translator here sees the same word, gyan, vigyan. So in conventional Hindi, vigyan is the word for science. So, but vigyan is also the word for yoga, just as we have physics and metaphysics. Similarly, gyan and vigyan. I think that he would have chosen to use the word discrimination to refer to when you've understood something and you've internalized that understanding, you're using that understanding with depth and wisdom. And so I think he's put the word discrimination to refer to that. In Brahma Kumaris, how we use the word gyan and vigyan is very often we will say, okay, yoga also means that you are so tuned in to what's happening that you know exactly what to say next, to do next, where the thing is going, and you're just really tuned, you see, knowledge is your theoretical, but then vigyan, you're right there, you see. It's a bit difficult to find good English words for that. And in the Sanskrit, you have gyan and vigyan. So in a way, it's the proof of yoga is that you keep your steady stage, circumstances go according to what is good for you, and you've arrived.
It's interesting that you mentioned a steady stage, because that is the description contained in Shloka 7, which speaks about somebody who's steadfast in cold, heat, pleasure and pain, honor and dishonor. And if one looks at the synonyms for steadfast, it is somebody who's unperturbed, somebody who is impartial. And one achieves this how, Sister Denise?
When you're perceiving something through your sense organs, and you say, according to my perception of this, this is that. But sense perception is, by definition, deceptive. So then, when you understand something because of what it is, rather than because of how you perceive it, is it different? All of these different things, gold, a clod, etc., etc., they're all matter. And the combination of elements of matter to make gold, we assign it more value to it. You're in a situation where there's no water. Water is valuable. So the value of something has to do with its scarcity rather than its intrinsic value. Do you see what I'm saying? So the yogi who...
That's a wow. The value of something has got to do with its scarcity. Explains why God is so popular, because no one has seen him in a while.
That's it. Anyway, yeah. So you see, the yogi is the person who's not looking at the value of the thing in terms of its scarcity value, but really seeing that all of these things are ultimately one and the same for him or her, because you're operating on a different level, I see. You're seeing the essential spirituality, the essential value of time, of people, of circumstances, of breath, mm-hmm. and you're using everything in a very good way. You're not deceived.
Yeah, Sister Denise, I think the mistake that we make is that we look at people's actions and what they say, and we make an assessment based on that. You're saying, do not look at what's presented on face value. Look at the being that's deeper than that.
Well, somebody can be very friendly and show themselves to be something because they have an ulterior motive.
That is true.
Which you find out a lot later after having, you know, given away your power and things like that. So this is where you're really using the word discrimination. And discrimination is one of the powers of yoga, and you have to really be a good judge of character to be able to know who's real, who's not real, who's lying, who's telling the truth, what's what. You're not shocked by it or moved by it, because what you want is to understand what is what, and then you act according to reality rather than according to perceived reality, which may be different.
If you interpret this line, he who is equal-minded towards friend, companion, and enemy. Sorry, I am now on shloka number 9. Okay, who is neutral among enemies and kinsmen, and who is impartial among the righteous and also amongst the evil, is to be distinguished among men. So to be this way is one thing, but how do you look after yourself? How do you protect your dignity? How do you engage in a manner that where the, you do not create a loss for yourself if you are this neutral?
You know, this shloka doesn't mean that you're stupid.
It doesn't mean that you're unable
to distinguish, but that you're unmoved by whether somebody's a friend or a foe. And it's all about being non-reactive. You know, when you use the word distinguished for a person, you say there's a very distinguished person, it means they have all the fine arts of conducting themselves in maybe very complex environment, but they will keep to their dignity. They will be very aware, but they won't show anything.
Okay, unfortunately, we have to say goodbye to you right now, and thank you so much for joining us today. There you have it. Sister Denise has shared her understanding of what it means to be neutral, of conquering the self, of understanding certain intricacies of the vocabulary that's used in the beginning of chapter 6. And I hope you have found this as insightful as I have. I particularly liked Sister Denise's churning and sharing on the aspect of handling pain and trauma. And it's a subject that most people choose to shy away from, but Sister Denise, being who she is, addresses it head on, and I think it's time most of humanity does as well. If you have any sort of pain, spirituality is not a cop-out or an escape route, but at some point you have to face who you've become and what you've become, including your past as well. So thank you for joining us. Thank you, Sister Denise, and we will see you for the next episode. Thank you and goodbye.